With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. Childhood is often depicted as the age of innocence, a time when our children are untainted by the murky world of sex and pleasure. But often when we realise that they are sexual beings, driven by curiosity and pleasure, it makes us feel extremely uncomfortable. Many wonder if this is normal behaviour. We might even recoil at the idea. With me today is Saskia Bujo, a relationship and sex educator who supports and answers the questions of confused parents. Thank you so much for joining me today, Saskia.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about the idea of our children being sexual beings. Yeah. And is it a myth that children aren't sexual at all? Because I think there is a general assumption that that is the case.
I mean, I think we need to go way back to how most children are made is through sex. And then I'm sure we'll get into conversation about sex not just being for baby making, but also for pleasure. But yeah, children feel pleasure in the womb. You know, their pleasure is their birthright. And so I think from a very young age, we can see babies, you know, discovering their hands, discovering their feet, putting their feet into their mouth and all these, you know, stages of development that we really welcome. And we want our children to feel pleasure. And then I think that there comes a point when we realize that they're discovering their private parts and their genitals where we suddenly think, oh my gosh. And I think you say quite rightly, you know, we recoil. We really do. You know, I spend my days talking about sex and relationship education, and I have those moments of anxiety. So I think it's really important to acknowledge those are very natural reactions to have. But I think we need to try and normalize the conversation around our children are sexual beings, and they have to be able to develop, you know, a comfortable zone in which they can feel pleasure. But they need support and guidance, and we need to be able to provide them with the structure in which it's safe to do so. And I think we, you know, as parents, we only want the best for our children in terms of them achieving healthy sexual relationships. And it's got to be worth the time and effort to help them achieve those relationships. You know, it's a really interesting time because I see, you know, I have three girls, my youngest is two, and I noticed with her more than the others when she began potty training, her genital area was a lot more free. And so she became much more exploratory. She was using her hands in between her legs a lot more than I'd noticed with the other two. And so even though I dish out this advice as a professional, as a mother, I have to, you know, I put myself back in the shoes of the anxious parent who doesn't really know how to react. And there is, and I see it, the temptation to say, you know, stop doing that or don't touch yourself there. And actually what we're doing is we are demonizing any kind of self-pleasure and touch. And then as our children become older, I think it's important to be able to say, well, it's okay for you to touch your own body because it's your body. And we get into the very early stages of the consent conversation. But then we start to bring in very slowly and gradually this conversation of privacy and boundaries. And so I often use the example with parents of, well, when we go to the toilet, that's something we do in private. You know, we don't all walk around touching ourselves. And so I think it's important to feel that we can allow our children the freedom to discover their own bodies because it is such a natural, a healthy part of their self-discovery and exploration, but to bring in the structure.
And I mean, you mentioned, you know, how you even notice the disparity between your children. Mm. I mean, I want to say what is normal and not normal, but I also appreciate that there is a huge difference between different children. I mean, some children, I think parents don't notice anything until they hit puberty.
Yeah.
And some babies are very exploratory. But on that spectrum of normal, really just to reassure parents, in terms of sort of sexual exploration, just with obviously with themselves, what is kind of the parameters of normal? Because I'm sure there are some parents who see their children, little boys fiddling with their willies, and they think, is my child
depraved? Yes. Or is there something wrong? Or is there something they've been exposed to that has given them ideas?
Well, I think there's two things when it comes to children discovering their bodies. There's them just on that level having discovered themselves. And so they're sort of fiddling around one day and they work out that they have this part of their anatomy and they just want to work out what it is. And then they might, as a result of that, find out that something feels nice. So there's that aspect that comes from just curiosity. And then there's the aspect of just self-soothing. And so, you know, for various reasons, and lockdown has been a really interesting time, I've had calls from parents who have obviously been at home much more with their children. So they're noticing a lot more changes in behaviour. They may be with their children who are a little bit more anxious because things are just different. And we know that children will react sometimes in very physical ways to any changes in their environment. And sometimes that means that they will soothe themselves through masturbation or just through fiddling around.
Everyone's got more time, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
In the classroom most of the
day. Yeah. So both of those things, I think, just need, they need addressing in the sense that we need to be able to say to them, well, we're not stigmatizing it, but we're providing them with a structure in which there is a time and a place for it to happen. And so with very young children, it's obviously quite difficult because of their language is somewhat restricted. You know, any child that's sort of under three, you're limited with how much you can explain. So I think it's just trying to very carefully trying to sort of direct that behavior into maybe giving them something that they can fiddle with in their hands. You know, if you're somewhere like a public library or you're somewhere where it's not appropriate to be having their hands down their knickers. So you're trying to redirect that sense of having to fiddle with something. When they start to get a little bit older, you can use language and you say, well, remember, this is okay to do this. And then I always like to say to parents, just check, you know, are you okay? Is something itching you or is something hurting? It's always good to try and rule out the fact that there might just be something that might need medical attention. And then you're also saying that you've observed that behavior and that you've observed it, but that you've acknowledged that it's okay for them to do that. And then once you've ruled out that it isn't anything itchy and that it is them self-soothing, that it is the self-soothing, then you acknowledge that that's also okay, but that you provide them with, you know, a time and a place for doing that. So again, that really depends. You know, every family is so different. So, you know, there are families who will be okay with children watching television and fiddling with themselves. And there are other families that will ask that their children go to their bedroom and do it. And so there really isn't a right or wrong answer there. It really depends on what you're comfortable with. But I think if the self-soothing is ongoing and you can see that your child is sort of going into sort of another world and they're basically pleasuring themselves to the point where they might be reaching orgasm, then that might be a time at which you might want to get some sort of support for that, because often it's to do with just having to maybe having experienced something uncomfortable, or they're trying to escape from some kind of, you know, trauma, or there are underlying issues sometimes with self-soothing that where we reach the point of orgasm. It's very common to see children in the car and rubbing the car seat against themselves, especially little girls. They work out that they can rub the car seat on their clitorises. That kind of behaviour doesn't concern me, because they've just worked out pleasure and they want to feel pleasure for whatever reason that is. And they don't have the notion of, you know, privacy. That's something that that's a layer that we bring to them. So the privacy layer is something that they don't have, that concept. You know, that's really for us to bring to the table.
And do you think there's an innate, like, I'm sure there are some children that somehow feel more comfortable doing this alone, or do you think all children need to be told, you know, you do this in private?
I think when children get to the point where they have worked out that private parts private, mm-hmm. then they might feel a little bit uncomfortable about touching themselves in front of other people. Mm-hmm. So usually that will be about age 5 and up. I mean, when I say ages, I'm always aware of children, you know, age and stage. But yeah, as soon as they have a concept of what's appropriate and what's not, mm-hmm. you know, at the age when they know it's not okay to run around the block naked anymore, mm-hmm. you know, I have an 8, 4, and 2-year-old, and my 4 and my 2-year-old are naked all the time at home, and my 8-year-old's just much more aware of what's appropriate. Mm. And so, yeah.
Which is a good thing. Because actually, and that's, you know, something, when you're 8, your body's on, yeah, you know, on the cusp of actually starting to change. And...
Absolutely. But I think, you know, what we model ultimately is the most powerful tool we have. We can preach as much as we like. If we're not practicing that, then it's a wasted opportunity, I think. And we don't walk around naked in the streets, and we don't walk around with our hands in our pants. So I think, you know, at some point our children will understand that, you know, there's a time and a place. I think it's really interesting to think about, you know, the anxiety that parents have around our children beginning to feel pleasure, because we, as parents or adults, we sometimes feel like pleasure is something that we need to earn or that we deserve if we've done something good, or on a very simple level, you know, if I've had a long day, I'm going to have a nice long bath, or, you know, I deserve this piece of chocolate because I've had, you know, a really healthy meal all day, just in that reward system. And so it's really interesting when we talk about pleasure, and I think it's the only way that we can try and help ourselves move through the discomfort is by really analysing our own sex education or lack thereof and our own history of sexual relationships and romantic relationships, because we know how harmful they can be and how, you know, potentially damaging they can be. So I think part of the conversation with children is, you know, trying to normalize the narrative around making pleasure okay, to know what is safe, and then they will know what is not safe. And ultimately it comes down to a big safeguarding issue.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than 1 billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And I suppose as parents, we've just got to be prepared for the fact that our children might well be, you know, curious about sex. Because it's not even just about self-pleasure. It's also, you know, you see some children that are just really curious about the act of sex. And that might not be that, you know, they're different or anything's wrong with them. Mm. They're just a little bit more curious, and maybe they are a little bit more likely to seek things out.
Yes.
You know, I've spoken to people where, you know, in that sort of school environment, there's one child that's really curious, and they've maybe, you know, a group of children have been caught looking at something that they shouldn't really have been looking at. Mm. And there are some parents that are in total denial. Well, it wasn't my child. There's no way they would have been interested in that. I mean, that doesn't strike me as particularly helpful in that situation. Mm. And but I think that probably stems from that sort of revulsion of my child is a little innocent, I don't know, 6-year-old.
Yeah.
There's no way they can be interested in that. Yeah. But actually, it's quite normal for them
absolutely.
To be curious.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing more normal in the world to want to know also where we came from. And so the conversation around sex is really interesting, because I see parents who say, oh, well, he's not ready. He hasn't asked me. And actually, I feel that there's a really good opportunity for parents to initiate the conversation, because that way they're just sending a really strong message about it's okay to have this conversation in our household. We talk about sex. You know, sex is not a dirty word. And, you know, I have other parents who say, well, I don't want to give him all the facts, because what if he goes to school and he tells his friends everything? I say he, it could well be she. And I think we're scared of that situation happening. But I always say, well, if what he is saying or she is saying is fact, and so much of sex and reproduction is fact, you know, it's later it gets complicated. But at the beginning, the layers, the foundations that we're creating are undeniable. And so we shouldn't be scared of our children talking about what is fact, because otherwise, if we don't give them the answers, then they're just going to find the answers elsewhere, which are either going to be online if it's, you know, plus 7, plus 8 years old, or through their peers who might not have the right information.
Well, at least you own the conversation then as a parent.
And then you own the conversation and you're saying, I talk about this with you. And you're also saying to your child that it's a normal part of life and it's a huge part of life. And, you know, we have a new curriculum now coming into schools, thank goodness, because the last one was from 2000. And so we think about how much society has changed in the last 20 years. Think about social media. Think about, you know, all the other aspects of our relationship and sex education, you know, pornography and all those types of things, which are now all part of the curriculum. But as I said, it gets so complicated later on when we've got to start talking to our children about, you know, what is sexual abuse? What is rape? What is pornography? We don't want to have that conversation at the same time as what sex is. We want to start with what healthy sex is, what consensual sex is. And then you start adding the layers, those complicated layers. And those are much more tricky conversations to have. But sometimes, and this is what I say to parents and carers a lot, is the value really is in bouncing back off each other. It's not necessarily in finding the perfect answer. It's in just seeing, well, you know, what is it that you know? And often they know more than we think they know. And then we can ask them the questions that we think they want to ask. And we're surrounded by these triggers for conversation all around us. And, you know, at a very young age, it can be just watching Cinderella dancing with the prince and saying, well, look, they are so happy together. They are starting to develop feelings of love. And he is letting her hold him and she is letting him hold her and they're dancing together. And that is the beginning of a really healthy relationship. And then it's up to us to drip feed in the other pieces of information to do with, now we have in the new curriculum, everything around sexuality, everything in orientation, gender. You know, we have all these complicated issues, which we're all scared of saying the wrong thing. And we're learning as we go along the way. But I always say to parents, you know, find your brave space. Yes, it's highly triggering in many ways because we're brought back to, oh my gosh, you know, this is what I didn't have. I didn't have this conversation. And so what is it that I would have liked to have had? And then what is it that I want for my child?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I remember so well being kind of at prep school and I was convinced that babies came out of mothers' tummies. Mm. Not quite sure how I thought they came out, but that's where they came out, I thought. And my friend Jessica said, no, they come out of their bottoms. And I was like, no, that's not right. It's out the tummies. I was like, I know, my father's a doctor. I know. And yeah. I'm going to check with him. And I remember so well sitting down at breakfast and he's like eating his muesli at sort of 7:30 on a Monday morning. I was like, Daddy, Jessica says babies come out of, you know, parent mummy's bottoms. Yeah. I thought they come out of their tummies. Yeah. I just remember my father literally just stopping. Yeah. But what's interesting is that I had no notion that this was potentially an awkward conversation to have.
Yes.
I was just like, the same as, you know, you sniff from your nostrils. It was a very sort of straightforward thing. And actually, as parents, you need to capitalise on that, don't you?
Definitely. I think you can miss the boat sometimes. But then I always like to say it's never too late either, because I don't like parents to worry that they have missed the boat. But there is that stage of development where the children haven't got that sense of what's awkward, what's embarrassing. That comes later. And so try and bank on that moment where, and that's the argument for talking about sex and relationships early, is that we are again normalizing the conversation, we're making it something okay to talk about. And they will, of course, at some point go, oh my gosh, okay, yeah, this is big. But that's okay. Name that reaction and just say, yeah, this is weird, isn't it? Or, you know, just be really human about it.
But don't pretend your child's not curious, even if they're
Six.
I mean, that sort of denial, it just seems like the biggest, you know, you're sort of letting your child down in a way if you're, I mean, interestingly, I definitely feel that kind of revulsion of the idea of my children being sexually active. Mm. I don't know, I don't know what that stems from. I mean, you sort of talk about sort of early experiences. But actually, if you think about it, children, people are hardwired to be curious about sex, because otherwise we wouldn't exist as a species.
Yes.
It's like sex is the most important thing we do while we're on this planet.
Yes.
And it is the most important sort of sense. So of course it's natural that children are going to be hard. I mean, it's almost more worrying if they're not.
Yeah. Well, I think as well, when children come to, you know, lead up to the questions that will require the answer, the penis goes into the vagina, we all absolutely cringe at the thought of having to say that. And if that is the first moment that your child has heard the word penis and the word vagina, then that is going to be, yes, a shock horror moment. So again, the argument for getting in there early is to introduce proper names for anatomy as early as possible, so that you've used the word penis in about, you know, as many contexts as you can in normal everyday life. And so that when you do come to say the word penis goes into vagina, then they're just thinking about the act. They're not thinking about, my God, what's a vagina? And so I'm sure we'll talk about proper and anatomical names as well at some point, but also that sex isn't just for making babies, and that actually some babies aren't made through sex. My babies weren't. My babies were made through IVF. So we have other conversations in my house as well, and we have lots of books about IVF. And so my daughter grew up knowing that she was made in a clinic, but not how, quote unquote, normal people make babies. So nowadays, there's a whole spectrum of how babies are made. You know, so many amazing assisted reproductive techniques that are available to us. But it's so important to talk about sex also in the context of pleasure. And this brings us back to self-pleasure. Because if we can help our children to realise that self-pleasure is acceptable, then they will know what those feelings are. And then they will know how to negotiate receiving pleasure from others, and then they will know when they don't want it. And that's something which all makes us, you know, just gives me goosebumps thinking about when my children won't want it. And that's, you know, one of the biggest jobs I feel I have, is to be able to empower my children to be able to say no to something. And that begins with, you know, we bought a book the other day called Please Don't Touch My Hair, and that's the beginning of that conversation. So trying to say, well, yes, babies are made this way, but we also do it because it feels nice.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to say that, but it's so important, because we're the ones that are feeling that, you know, sweaty anxiety. They will, you know, go back to building Lego.
So. It is amazing. I remember so well being with my children, and actually my nephew and niece, and we were in a restaurant up in the mountains in Austria, and my brother-in-law brought out this little survival kit, and in there was, you know, a piece of string and some matches, and there was a condom. I was like, oh, what do you need that for? And he goes, it's actually the perfect thing for collecting water, because it's really small and it's watertight.
Yeah.
And I remember my son, who was probably about 7 at the time, went, oh, is that what a condom is for, collecting water?
Yeah.
And I remember looking over at my sister, and we both just were like, we can't just say yes.
Yes.
And so we said, actually, no, a condom is, and I told them what it was for. Mm. Obviously in language, in a way that was
age appropriate.
But I mean, I said, you know how I talked to them all about sex at that stage. I said, you know, sometimes people don't want to have babies. You'd like a bit like a sock.
Yes.
You prevent, it's like a gate that stops the sperm going in.
Yes.
And they were like, okay. And then the next question was, can we have chips with our meal?
Yes.
Like, it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't like everyone sat there in stunned silence thinking,
yes,
oh my God, this is the biggest watershed moment.
Yes.
They were like, okay, in the same way that I told them how to use nail clippers to cut your toenails. You
exactly.
know, it was very straightforward. Yes. And it because we didn't sit down and go, right, I need to talk to you about contraception. And I remember then I was talking to another friend, and she said, oh, you know, the problem is that you're so honest with your children, they're just going to go around and tell all their friends about it in the playground. And I said, I really don't think that's going to be the case, because I'm so honest with them.
Mm.
Like, it's not a big deal. Mm. They'd much rather play tag.
Yes.
They're not going to be like, oh my God, I just found out what a condom was.
Yes. Because it's not taboo for them.
Yeah, and it wasn't presented in that sort of sensationalist way. And I also felt that when someone does, you know, inevitably in the playground, people will be like, condom, sex, whatever. You know, my children will be like, yeah, I know what a condom is. Like, yeah. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
Which I think will make them the coolest kids in the playground.
Absolutely.
Rather than the one that's yeah. like, did you know there's this thing called yes. a condom?
Yeah.
And, you know, suddenly it feels like they'd just be a bit more mature. So I feel that by having that honest conversation with them, I've kind of empowered them to be
definitely
a bit more resilient and...
Yeah. And also banking on those, you know, we call them teachable moments. You know, what's this? What's this condom? And those are moments that, you know, as a mother and as a sex educator, I really look forward to those. And sometimes they happen in the most inconvenient places and situations. And this brings me back to parents and carers who are not prepared to answer the question because they might not feel confident enough to. And so there's always the opportunity to say, this is a really good question. We'll come back to this. I'm going to find a way of answering this question for you, but we can't talk about this now. And I think there's so much value in saying that, but also that you don't have the answer. That's quite empowering for them to see that also you're not this perfect human that has the answer to everything, but must get back to them. There are so many resources now to help parents have these conversations and that basically do the work for us. I mean, in the early years, and I'm talking, you know, my daughter's 8, but we still read them. There's a wealth of books on how babies are made, but also sex for pleasure, the different ways of making babies, and just simple anatomy and talking about, you know, this is your arm, this is your leg, this is your vulva, this is your penis, and just trying to use those words and say them as often as possible.
Because why should we be scared of saying the word vagina? And yet it's so rarely used in everyday narrative.
Yeah, well, apparently only 1% of us say vulva, which is the word anatomically that we should be saying is vulva, but we've been saying vagina for years. And, you know, there's a vagina museum, but it actually should really be called a vulva museum. And apparently only 1% of us say vulva. And I think it's just years and years of stigma that have just created this very hard shell that means that we can't call a spade a spade.
And what do you think? I mean, there are plenty of people that, you know, find that don't use the word vulva, but they also don't
use
the vagina.
Which is fine also. Yeah, I mean, also, you know, with my eldest, we didn't call it vulva or vagina. We had another name. And then I came to that later when I started realizing that actually there's an opportunity here to really normalize language. And it is absolutely fine to have all those code names, provided they also know the proper name. And there's several reasons for that. One is obviously to normalize as much as possible conversation, but for them also to feel a sense of ownership of, this is my vulva, these are my inner lips, these are my outer lips, this is my penis, these are my testicles, and to be really, you know, specific about parts of their anatomy. And especially for girls who can't see, you know, what it looks like. And so I do often encourage parents who have children who are exploring, who have girls who are exploring their genitals, to take a mirror and to show their girls what it looks like, because they're discovering with their hands, because they're curious. So, you know, feed into that curiosity and squat over a little mirror and just show them and explain to them that we have three holes and they have different functions. And again, these are facts. You know, this isn't anything that we're debating on. You know, urethra is for passing urine. Your vagina is for passing blood later on when you'll hit puberty. You know, it's another conversation we need to prepare them for. And your anus is for passing waste. So these are all, you know, they're functional parts of our body that serve a really clear purpose.
Do you not think that by giving it a code name, though, you're sort of somehow insinuating that vulva or vagina are dirty words?
Definitely. So if you can do both, if you can do one, then it would ideally be vulva or vagina. But if you're going to do both, then just make sure that you have your code name, but you also have your proper name. For safeguarding reasons, sorry, that's my last reason, is if they're in a context where you're not there and they have some discomfort in that area, that they can go to a trusted adult at school or somewhere and say, well, do you know what, my vulva's really itchy, or, you know, my testicle's sore, and they can be really specific about that. And then you're also doing that in the context of privacy, and that takes us back to a safeguarding issue. Yeah, I would hope that in generations we wouldn't have any more code names. And I feel like we are getting there. We definitely are getting there. But it's you know, we don't call breast. We have 100 names for breasts as well. It's really interesting to think about why all this started in the first place. But I think we definitely are progressing there.
Mm. Yeah, it's. I mean, some of these names are just, they're almost like really sexual.
Yeah.
In a way, which then sort of feel, I find that the sort of fact based, like you were talking about, just gives you so much. It makes that conversation so much easier.
Mm.
Whereas if you're calling them like your sexy bits, it's sort of, A, it's really vague.
Yes.
And B, I just feel a bit uncomfortable about a four-year-old talking about sexy bits when actually this is a chance to say...
Yeah, sexy bits is a bit disturbing. The one that gets me is front bottom.
Yes.
I find that one difficult. But I think it's just because have done what our parents have done. And then we realise, well, I didn't really like that name, so I'll find another name. And so we'll hear what our friends say or, you know, what we've read online. And so we do that. But I think that there is so much more of a movement now to try and normalise and use proper anatomical names. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyone that does use code names, you know, just slowly bring in, and there's an opportunity. They go to the toilet 4 or 5 times a day at least, an opportunity to say, you know, well, wipe your vulva this way, and when you're in the bath, wash your vulva, wash your anus, you know, did you know that this was called this? And again, use the books, because the books are really fantastic. So
do you think that it's better to have this conversation one-on-one, or is it sometimes easier to have it in, no, I'm not talking in a group, but say you've got 3 children that are all sort of around the same age and can, you know, same, you know, area of understanding. Is it better to have it one-on-one, or is it better to have it in a group?
If you feel able to have it in a group, then you're sending quite a strong message that you talk about these things openly in your household. I think there's age-appropriate conversations. If you're getting into, you know, if I was answering the condom question or the sex question, then actually I probably would do it in front of my 4 and my 2-year-old, because it would probably fly over my 2-year-old's head. She wouldn't have a clue what I was talking about. But I'm trying to think with my own children, there generally isn't anything that I say to my 8-year-old in secret. So from a very personal point of view, for me, it's about having those conversations as openly as you can. And we have them also with you know, friends who come around as well. I mean, in my office, I have a wealth of different resources, including things like crochet vulvas and a whole box of, you know, model contraception kits and things like that. And I have had to, on a few occasions, say to parents of children who come play with us, you know, they have been playing in my office today, and so they have seen the crochet vulvas.
Imagine the child went, hang on, we played with,
yeah,
so this is mother's,
yeah,
vulva.
So, yeah.
What?
Yeah. So there, I do feel quite strongly that they are, you know, conversations that we have in our household. Yes, you can play with this in our household. My daughter knows what they are. I don't hide anything from her. And, you know, anyone who comes into our household and sees those things, you know, I don't want them to leave feeling alarmed. Obviously, that's not the idea. The idea is to just show them what it is in a very normal way. And most of the time, like you say, they don't bat an eyelid. They just want, you know, to go back to their Lego. But I always tell whoever's collecting them, and if it's not the parent, then I will always let them know, just to let you know, yeah. We've been playing with crochet vulvas today.
And do you think that, I mean, you've obviously got daughters, but if you had a son, would it be easier for the father of the child to talk to them? Or do you think that kind of the same sex should talk about it, or should it come from both parents?
Ideally, it's equal.
Yeah.
Because you're sending a strong message about genders being able to talk about pretty much anything. But I always say, if the topic of conversation is hugely triggering for you, then try and pass the buck to the other one who feels more comfortable with it. So most people will say, you know, when I teach parents and I'll ask them, you know, what was your sex education like? I think very rarely one person will say amazing. Most of the time it's virtually non-existent. If they had some form of sex ed at home with their parents, there was always one parent that they tended to go to more than the other. And sometimes that's not necessarily to do with them having all the answers. It's just that they were more approachable. So in our household, you know, I think my husband would sort of steer it more my way. But having said that, there's nothing he won't talk about either. So in an ideal world, it would come from both parents equally.
And yeah. I think that as you as your journey of as a parent evolves, you become the conversations that you think are going to be impossible to have become a little bit easier than you anticipate. I remember so well, my husband got a tattoo when I was pregnant with Ludo, I think, literally on the floor of a pub, like totally inappropriate. And I was like, right, for that, you're going to have to do the sex talk with our children. And actually, having been quite squeamish about it, I'm on, you know, totally different party because I've educated myself in that, but also because I realized that having difficult conversations with your children really just brings you a bit closer. I think they feel really proud that you entrust them, you know, to have this difficult conversations. And I've actually got friends who say, oh, you're so good at that sex talk. And actually, my children always come home sort of armed with stuff that I wish they'd known. Yeah. And I think in a weird way, my children feel quite proud that they've got the parent, that they can kind of ask, or the parents, they can ask anything to.
Absolutely. And I think this goes back to, if they're not getting the answers from us, they will seek them elsewhere. You know, I have a very close relationship with my mother, and she was always the person that all my friends would steer to as well. And she would always have an open house for us all, because she thought, well, at least I know where you are. At least you're not, you know, hanging out on street corners and that kind of thing. So that was always a really strong message from her. And I think, yeah, coming back to what you're saying, we want to sort of redirect to someone else. But actually, when we put ourselves in that zone with our children, we work through the discomfort together. And I always say, you know, name that and say, yeah, this is a tricky conversation for mummy, or, you know, mummy never had this conversation with granny. And show them that you feel a little bit, you know, perhaps stressed by that as well, but work through that together. And again, use the tools, use the books. You know, I will share some resources. There are now many fantastic YouTube videos that you can watch with your children about other parents talking to their children about sex. And then you can be the person that's sort of saying, well, what did you think about that? And as I said, it's not about necessarily about saying what the right answer is, but about getting them to think critically, you know, giving them the fact, but then adding the layers of, well, think critically about, you know, well, what would you have liked, or what would you have done, and how would you have reacted to that? So that they can be, as you say, this sort of source of knowledge amongst their friends as well, for them to be able to share the information. Because they will at some point realise that they've been really lucky to have this open conversation at home, because maybe not all their friends will. And I'm hoping that gratitude will be shown at some point to say, well, thanks for that, Mum.
I mean, obviously, there's this sort of stage where you're talking about this and you kind of, as a parent, you think, brilliant, I control this situation. Mm. You know, I am in charge of naming these parts. I'm in charge of kind of forming her opinion. But obviously, our children grow up and then they become teenagers, and then they do start experimenting and being curious and sharing that experience with other people, which I think is, you know, there's one thing getting around sort of talking about sex with your little child.
Yeah.
There is a different thing getting used to the idea that your child is kissing someone and maybe feeling someone and maybe even having sex with someone, which I think is quite hard as a parent. I mean, I feel I'm dreading that.
Yeah.
I'm going to be totally honest.
Yeah.
Why do we feel so squeamish about our children becoming sexually active? I mean, I spoke to a father the other day. He was like, I literally feel like I want to lynch the guy that kisses my daughter.
Yes.
And obviously that's not a good feeling to have. And, you know, he'd be the first person to admit that. But yet we have these feelings.
Yeah. I mean, it's so difficult because, you know, we've cared for these children since day one. And we have to at some point let them, we know we have to at some point let them go. And we dread the situation. But I think ultimately it comes down to just wanting to protect them. And I think this is where a lot of parents get a bit confused, perhaps when they think that protecting means not informing them honestly about what life is really like later on. And I think protecting them is equipping them with the tools to be able to manage all those situations. And so, yeah, we absolutely cringe at the thought of it, because it's our children allowing someone to be physically close to them. And we're the ones that have been so physically close to them for years.
It's basically being dumped.
Yeah, for someone else. I mean, I get very few hugs from my 8-year-old now. I have to bribe her. But when I do, I really hold her tight, because I know that, you know, she now has the right to say no. to me. Well, they all have the right to say no, but I have to really listen to her. She's very we've had the consent conversation since very young. So she said, no, I've asked you to stop. I don't like kisses. And I've said no, so you must listen to me. So we have all those conversations. But yeah, I think it's just such a natural reaction for parents to feel that anxiety. And it does come back to the fact that we know the potential for, you know, physical touch going wrong. And so we want to protect our children from any risk involved, and we want to be guarding them safely as possible. But preparing them without scaring them is educating them the best we can on what is safe touch. And
being a real bitch to their boyfriends is not going to help matters at all.
I mean, no.
I kind of feel like I'm going to have to get my feelings sorted out, because I don't want suddenly my daughter or my son to feel unwelcome at my house with their partner.
Yeah.
I also, you know, it's interesting. I spent a bit of time in Spain when I was in my early 20s, and, you know, my parents were quite liberal and thought, well, we'd rather whatever's happening is under our roof. And in Spain, you know, the parents were all in denial about what their children were getting up to. Mm. And as a result, it was happening in a really seedy way in the back of cars and in their father's offices. Yes. And I just remember thinking, I'm so grateful that I had that sort of acceptance. I think that is really important, even if it is something as a parent you feel uncomfortable about the idea of your child having sex in
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the foundations of helping our children with romantic relationships begins much earlier. It begins when they're navigating friendships. And so when our children come to us with what we think might be something really trivial, like he wouldn't sit next to me at lunch, or, you know, Juliet wouldn't play with me in the playground or something like that, we often think, oh, well, you know, come on, be resilient, be strong. And we think, don't give it too much attention. But actually, those are really good opportunities to help children understand, well, how friendship works. You know, that friendship is built on values, it's built on respect, on love, on kindness, on all these really important points that are ultimately the foundation of a romantic relationship and then a sexual relationship. Because that's what we all really want, is that for our children who are going to be sexual, to have healthy sexual relationships. And the best chance of them achieving those is by understanding what those relationships are built on. And we really want that to be friendship. You know, we spend so much of our lives building towards, you know, the aspiration is that we need to meet this one person, you know, and no matter how much we like to try and challenge that stereotype, it is inevitably around us, this aspiration of two people meeting and spending their life together. And, you know, it's interesting, the curriculum now, it talks about marriage, but it talks about all different kinds of family structures. And so, you know, there are a lot of single parent families, there are a lot of same sex families, and that is represented in the curriculum now, and also in books around us as well, so that we can begin to show children that there are many different structures to what relationships are. But we are also saying that happiness is meeting someone else. And so I think when we say be kind to others, I always try and say, well, be kind to yourself first. And, you know, you will attract happy things if you're happy yourself. And so always trying to, you know, start from within. I know that sounds cheesy, but trying to really get parents to understand that, you know, the values that we want to sort of, you know, seek out in a partner are the values that we hold dearly towards ourselves and towards our siblings. And all those values, you know, studies have shown that, you know, no matter what happens at school or no matter what happens in our society or communities, it's really the values in the home that bear the most impact on a child forming an identity. I've digressed massively here, sorry.
Have you ever encountered a parent who said, like, I need some therapy because I really cannot abide the idea of my child being sexually active?
I mean, I would never say to a parent, you know, you don't need therapy. I think everyone needs therapy, whether you're happy or not. I think therapy is a fantastic tool if you can do it. But I do see that parents are, you know, I had a mum over lockdown saying, you know, I think my son's a pervert and he was four. And I just, I felt so much, you know, compassion, and I felt so upset for her that she felt that, because what her son was doing was basically fondling himself, was discovering himself, was a completely natural thing. But she came from a very religious background where you just didn't talk about sex in her household. And so she almost needed, you know, she would have benefited from some kind of conversation to acknowledge, you know, why she had that, why she'd stigmatized that. And, you know, when we demonize that, we really need to search deeper about why we hold those feelings towards, you know, our children becoming sexual beings. But to answer your question, everyone needs therapy, in my view.
Because I don't know if you've, actually, I think you probably have watched it, is Sex Education.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And it's a fantastically written, but part of me just like feels so fear, because these children are like 15, 16, and they're all involved sexually with each other, with everything at such a young age. Is that reflective of what life really is like, or is this just, you know, fiction?
I mean, yeah, I think it reflects life, if I'm honest. When I think back to, you know, what I was doing, I'll happily share when I was 15 or 16, if my children are doing that, shock horror. But no, I had boyfriends when I was 16, 17, and, you know, I had a few relationships before I met my husband. And so, and I now see the value in those relationships, and they have made me who I am today. And you know, my father, who's a very open, realistic man, who's very laid back in his attitudes, he was like, the worst thing you can do is marry the first person you meet. You want experience and you want to learn from past relationships. But there's a fantastic scene in Sex Education where Jean Milburn, who's played by Gillian Anderson, finds the sheets under her son's bed with the sperm on them. And her shock, horror. And this is a woman whose house is filled with all sorts of phallic symbols and who speaks about clitorises and penises all day. Because it's her job, yeah. And she finds these sheets under the bed, and she obviously, you know, just to give a bit of background on the series, her son has been having trouble. He's been masturbating but not being able to ejaculate. And so she's finally realized, and she has the evidence that he's ejaculated, and she knows she should be pleased, but she's actually, you know, shock horror strikes her face. And that's a really interesting conversation that I've had with parents about, I've seen this, what do I do? And it really depends. If ideally parents will have had a conversation already about puberty by then, and you know, when we talk in relationship sex education context, we talk about preparing before the events happen. So you prepare your children for puberty before puberty starts. You know, so many hormonal changes that are going to happen that are going to make it difficult anyway. But if they're unprepared, then we're looking at children who are going to be, you know, wondering what on earth is happening to their poor bodies. So again, we're trying to normalize that. But I expect that, you know, Jean Milburn in Sex Education will have already spoken to her son, Otis, about, and she would have used the words penis, she would have used the word erection, she would have used the word sperm, she would have probably used the term morning glory or something like that. So that, yes, it feels not taboo to him, but it feels a little bit naughty to him, but that he knows deep down that it's okay to be doing this. And I think that's the balance that's really tricky to achieve, is it's that, yes, it's okay to talk about this, but it's still private. And I think that's, I don't have all the answers there.
And
I'm still working them out.
You know, how you might have one child that's quite keen to divulge and to share, and then you might have one child who's signalling to you, I do not want to have this conversation. Obviously, it's really important to have a form of conversation, but presumably also have to, you know, look at the signs. And if you've got a really shy child who just finds it excruciating, you're not going to probe and probe and probe. You're going to give them the facts.
Yes.
You're going to make sure that they know that they can ask you about anything, but you're not going to torture them with sort of, you know, wanting to talk about vulvas every breakfast.
Yeah. And I think, again, there's, you know, so much to be said for books for children who don't want to talk about it. And they are storybooks. They're not nonfiction. And I think there's so much value in them just listening to something and looking at something without feeling like they're being told something. I'm saying that in a really simple way, but essentially it's about just taking the information in as a witness and not being instructed, you know, how things work, but just to observe. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, I've been teaching for many years, and there are, I don't like to put children in boxes, but there are really two categories when we come to learn, and it's those that throw themselves in at the deep end and those that sit back and observe. And sometimes it takes those children a little bit longer to put their feet in the water, but eventually with the right support they do. And that's really us as parents, who are the ones that know our children really the best, is to know how much they can cope with. And this, you know, the conversation around relationship and sex education is, there's a bit of a misconception around, I think you've mentioned it before, about it being one big kitchen table talk. And actually it's layers of really appropriate information that's drip fed, you know, for years and years. Mm. And finding the clues in the right context around us, and using those as conversation starters, so that we're not just dumping this information out of the blue, which is nothing worse. And we're surrounded by it, you know. A pregnant neighbor, you know, well, how do you think Maria got pregnant? You know, what do we need to make babies? And ask them the questions mm-hmm. that you want mm-hmm. them to ask you. Leaving tampons around the house, or, you know, if and when you shave your legs, well, why is that? And do we need to? And all those conversations that we need to try and teach our children to, you know, this is, yes, how people have behaved for generations, but to get them to think critically about whether that's right for them and what message we're trying to give. I think, you know, when we talk about older children, they then become so exposed to different images around them. I think, you know, children who have devices see about 5,000 different images a week. And it was really interesting, actually. I taught a class a month ago on body image, and we were talking about the different types of images that we see, and about photoshopping and manufacturing, doctoring images, and what the purpose of those images are for, you know, what advertising is, you know, why it's marketed this way, who's the target market, and really getting deeply into what the purpose is of all these images, and, you know, why are we always seeing the same things? And I think that's the beginning of thinking critically. And then when children come to see explicit images, you know, in pornography, you know, parents have often come to me once their child has seen an explicit image, whether it's on their own device because they haven't put filters on, or whether they've gone to a friend's house for a play date and there's an older sibling and also no parental controls. And that's also an opportunity to get your children think critically about what they're seeing, so that they don't see that as reality, but that they see it as something that is very much set up and that is trying to access a specific target market, and the inappropriateness of it, without trying to demonize it, which is obviously a very difficult thing to do. But yeah, it's a really interesting conversation when we come to think about images and what we see. And so if you can start having that conversation early with them about, well, it's interesting, we keep seeing Coca-Cola everywhere, or, you know, why do we always see this Heinz? Why is Heinz everywhere? You know, we think of tomato soup, we think Heinz, and just on a very basic level. And then we can begin to add the layers of that in a sexual context. Mm-hmm. I've digressed again.
Oh, well, Saskia, I so enjoyed talking to you. And I'm so proud that we're having this conversation, because I don't think my parents' generation did necessarily have this as honestly. And I think that there will be people listening who will find this conversation harder to have and might even be shocked at some of the things that we've talked about. But I think even just, you know, wanting to be a part of this conversation and beginning to understand how, what an important conversation that it is, I think is a crucial thing. And hopefully we're becoming better communicators as parents, and that's only going to empower and safeguard our children to a greater extent.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for, you know, for any parent who's struggling with the conversation, my advice is just find some support. And whether that's talking to someone, you know, your partner, talking to friends, or finding some resources. Because, you know, the not talking to our children about this is also saying something. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. And so where would you find resources? What would you search in YouTube? I can always put notes kind of in the, yes, in the podcast episodes. So yeah. We can go
so
through
what
that.
I on my Instagram account, I've created little stories where I've basically taken lots of pictures of different books. But just to throw a few out there for the early years, anyone sort of 8 and under, and we're looking at fiction, there's a fantastic author called Babette Cole who does a lot on nudity, body hair, how to make babies, the beginning of consent. She's a fantastic author. So you can look up anything by Babette Cole. And she also addresses the sort of stereotypes as well. She's done Princess Smarty Pants, which is good fun. Mummy Laid an Egg is her other good one. And What Mummy Never Told Me. Those are all fantastic books. And then you've obviously got all the nonfiction for the slightly older age group, which is, you know, Why Talk? Where Do Babies Come From? Things like that. So it's always worth having a look at just what, you know, what the Amazon says under sex ed for children. They have a big section there for children. So do that. There's also a fantastic website called Scarletine, which is for slightly older children, I'd say from 8+. And then there's also, I mentioned some videos. There's an organization called amaze.org, and they have videos on safe touch, consent, puberty, so you can actually sit down and watch the video with your child and then you discuss it. For parents, there's a fantastic organization called Sex Positive Families, and she has a podcast, she runs webinars, and she has lots of free resources on her website, and she's my go-to, Sex Positive Families. And for short drives to school, 6 minutes Sex Ed is another podcast.
That's great.
Where she goes into different topics as well. So, but if you go into your podcast section, you can type in Sex Ed. You know, generally, we all are singing from the same hymn sheet these days. So I think you can't go wrong by trying to find good resources.
Perfect. Well, I've actually loved your Instagram, which is factsoflife.ed. Just lots of different sort of pause for thought and different ways of interpreting, you know, challenges you face as parents. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
Saskia, it's been a real pleasure having you on. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Such a great communicator around this topic. And thank you all for downloading another episode of The Parenthood. You can follow Saskia, as I talked about, on factsoflife.ed on Instagram. I'm also marina.fogel. If you have any questions, I'll put show notes in the bottom of this podcast. But in the meantime, from Saskia and me, thanks for listening and goodbye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.